This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Anis Haidari. This is Your World Tonight. This Thanksgiving weekend, many Canadians could go hungry as food banks in major cities say they are stretched too thin. Demand is up and donations are down. As Jasper, Alberta tries to rebuild for the winter tourist season, some residents say places to live are even more scarce than before. And we'll tell you about the growing political debate over forcing people with mental health and addictions issues into treatment. But we begin our program in Florida. Along Florida's Gulf Coast, streets are lined with debris. Piles of siding, furniture, and appliances are all that remain of many homes. Joe Biden surveyed that wreckage today. It was the U.S. president's second visit to Florida this month after it was walloped by a 1-2 punch of powerful hurricanes. The CBC's Aaron Collins is on the ground in Tampa.
I'm here in Florida for the second time in 2 weeks.
Days after Hurricane Milton blew through, Joe Biden touched down in Florida. The president arriving with a commitment to spend more than $600 million to beef up the region's power grid.
This funding will not only restore power, but will make the region's power system stronger and more capable and reduce the frequency and duration of power outages while extreme weather events become more frequent.
That's a pressing need. More than a million people still without power in the state. Stalling efforts to get life back to normal. Nicole Kemp and her three kids clean up their yard in Tampa. Their house too hot without air conditioning.
We haven't had power since before the storm, and it's cooler outside than it is inside. Surrounding areas have power, and so hopefully it's trickling down. But Thursday is what we've been told.
50,000 workers from around the U.S. and as far away as Canada working to get the lights back on. Fuel, another pressing concern for Floridians. Many gas stations bone dry. Long lines at those that still have gas. Police directing traffic.
All the way to the end. First pump.
The fuel shortage more than an inconvenience for Donna Rhodes. Her landscaping business depends on it.
We have a bunch of trucks, and right now we couldn't find any gas. And turn around, I sat in the line here yesterday for like 3.5 hours, and an officer came up and said they didn't have no gas at all.
On the other side of the state, people are cleaning up after the tornadoes that came in Milton's wake.
It was like a train coming over my roof. I was so frantic.
At this home, a near miss. But just meters away from Joan Kaiser's house in St. Lucie County, a hit.
Just over on the other side of the fence there, loss of life, right?
Yes, sadly, yes, very sad. And I look at that and I just can't fathom being in a house that has collapsed like that.
At least six people died in that neighboring community, enough to make Kaiser, who rents, think twice about sticking around.
But I don't think I'll buy a house and be here permanently. I want to be able to pick up and go if I need to or want to.
That fear replaced by frustration at this community center, set up to help impacted Floridians like Brenda Hayes get the help they need to rebuild.
I'm telling you, it's broken. Our federal, state, and local levels, they're broken. And with my dying breath, I'm going to stand up and say enough is enough.
There is much to fix here in Florida, this state reeling from a devastating hurricane season that isn't over yet. Aaron Collins, CBC News, Tampa, Florida.
The United Nations peacekeeping force in Lebanon is accusing Israel of violating its positions in the country. UNIFIL says Israeli tanks forcibly broke through the main gate of one of its bases just before dawn this morning. Israel's military says the tank crashed into the compound by accident, trying to escape attacks from Hezbollah militants. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu issued a warning to UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
Mr. Secretary General, get the UNIFIL forces out of harm's way. It should be done right now, immediately.
At least five UNIFIL peacekeepers have been injured in recent days from Israeli strikes in southern Lebanon. But the UN is refusing to move. and says any attacks on their staff could be considered a war crime. This Thanksgiving, many Canadians are coming together over large family meals, but many others are facing a more meager reality. And in some of Canada's largest cities, food banks are being stretched to the limit as many continue to struggle with the cost of living. Katie Nicholson reports.
Dozens of volunteers pack food hampers in a Toronto warehouse. Even as they sort towering stacks of canned goods,
and then there's pork and beans.
They know it may not be enough.
Well, the rise in food bank usage is at a level that we've never seen before. It's a horrific situation.
Neil Hetherington is the CEO of Daily Bread. He says by the time the average Toronto food bank user has paid their rent, they have about $6 a day to live on. And their numbers are growing. In most of Ontario, food bank demand is up nearly 25%. In the GTA, that number has skyrocketed to 58%.
But unfortunately, our donations only increased by 2%.
Megan Nichols is the CEO of Food Banks Mississauga. She says roughly 27% of food bank users there have a job, sometimes more than one, and are finding it increasingly hard to make ends meet.
We start to see more people tell us, hey, last year I sent some cans of tuna with my kids to their school for their school food drive, and this year I'm here turning to the food bank for help.
The GTA isn't alone. The Calgary Food Bank says the amount of donated food on its shelves is down 51% from last year. The strain's also being felt at the Depot Community Food Center in Montreal.
We've been around for almost 40 years, and it's the first time in 40 years of existence that we've ever had to have a waiting list and that we've been turning people away to this extent.
Executive Director Tasha Lackman says Depot staff are haunted by the people they have to turn away.
It's a terrible feeling.
Soup, good soup. Okay, soup is over here.
Back at the Toronto warehouse, Mayor Olivia Chow and Ontario Premier Doug Ford acknowledge affordable housing is a big part of the problem.
For our city government, the best way we can do is provide more affordable housing.
We need the Bank of Canada to lower the interest rates that people can go out and afford an affordable mortgage.
Neil Hetherington hopes more people put pressure on politicians to take action on affordability.
Not everybody can donate food or funds, but everybody can advocate for change.
Change, he hopes, will come before next Thanksgiving. Katie Nicholson, CBC News, Toronto.
Still ahead, overcrowded tourist attractions have become a fact of life in many European cities, but in Rome, officials want to ease up on the flow of visitors by making it a little more expensive. Will visitors to a famous fountain dry up if they have to pay up? That's coming up on Your World Tonight. A provincial election issue in both BC and New Brunswick is spilling over into federal politics. It's around expanding involuntary treatment for some people with mental health and addictions issues. Some call it compassionate care. Others say it's unconstitutional. Nick Murray on the divisive debate to force treatment on people who don't want it.
What about people who want treatment?
Kathy Moreland is a retired nurse from Kitchener, Ontario. 4 years ago, her 18-year-old son Austin died from a suspected fentanyl overdose. She says he wanted treatment but couldn't get it. Moreland says if provinces are moving towards involuntary treatment, they'd better have the supports in place once patients are released.
I think politicians are, you know, using this rhetoric to appeal to a public that doesn't understand just how complex this issue is.
We need to ban hard substances.
On Thursday, federal conservative leader Pierre Poilievre was asked for his stance.
I believe for children and for prisoners who are behind bars, there should be mandatory drug treatment when they are found to be incapable of making decisions for themselves. For adults, again, I'm still doing a lot of research on how that would work.
The debate about the use of involuntary treatment comes as 21 Canadians died every day on average from opioid use between January and March of this year, though Statistics Canada reported an 8% drop in deaths compared to the same time last year.
We've never had better tools in our toolkit than before.
Dr. David Gratzer is a psychiatrist at the Centre for Addiction and Mental Health in Toronto. He says Canada should be building up those tools already in place to give people the best chance at sobriety.
opioid agonist treatments, those are treatments built on substitute drugs like methadone. They themselves can reduce mortality alone by 50%, literally life-saving medications. And yet we know most people with substance problems have no access to that treatment.
Before we contemplate voluntary or involuntary treatment.
On Friday, Canada's Addictions Minister Yara Sachs said provinces need to scale up existing programs.
This is about political will and allocating the resources that they have to providing treatment access to those who need it in a way that is timely and accessible.
Sachs says right now, Canada doesn't have enough treatment beds, even for people who want them. Nick Murray, CBC News, Ottawa.
With 6 days to go before the BC election, pollsters have their eye on the voting choices of younger people. Voters under 35 now make up the largest group of voters in the country, and potentially in British Columbia too. But as Yvette Brand explains, that's if they vote.
I'm majoring in poli sci at UBC, so I feel like that's definitely my thing.
One in five voters in British Columbia are under the age of 35. That makes Gen Z and millennials like this 19-year-old UBC student a key focus for candidates. BC Conservative leader John Rustad signaled he cares about young people multiple times in last week's election debate.
One in three people are thinking about leaving this province. One in two youth can't see a future by staying in British Columbia.
Young voters remain a real wild card, according to Steve Mossop, the executive vice president of Léger's Western Canadian polling team.
Youth are a tricky one. There's rare elections, even around the world, where youth have transformed and made an election different than what it could have been.
He's seen a real lean to the right amongst young voters.
There just seemed to be a movement afoot across the country and in BC towards the right. And that trend's been entrenched for a couple of years now.
Voters like Nolan Gorlick say many his age want to kick out current leaders.
Russ had mentioned like one of two youth is like thinking of getting the hell out of here.
Is that you?
Because, I'd say it's a thought that's come to my mind.
Analysts like Simon Fraser University political scientist Sanjay Jerram say many young voters feel failed by current leaders.
Younger generations in the past, there'd always been a greater sense of hope.
A lot of that relates to housing.
There's lots of jobs out there, but it's affordability. They can't afford to pay the rent. So, you know, the 28-year-olds are living in their parents' basements because they can't afford a place. Their wages don't support that.
I can see their perspective on that because we've had the NDP in government for a while and perhaps they're not seeing the change that they expected.
But others, like 19-year-old political science student Anushka Sharma, say they don't see enough choice on the ballot.
I wish that BC United didn't drop out because I feel like now there's just like two choices. It's very polarized.
But plan to hold their nose and vote strategically to at least get closer to where they want the province to be. Yvette Brand, CBC News, Vancouver.
With the busy winter tourism season ahead, different levels of government are trying to get Jasper, Alberta back up and running. A wildfire destroyed about 30% of Jasper's buildings last summer, and that is leaving many who want to be in town for work trying to find a place to stay. Sam Sampson reports.
Mere steps separate Sviatoslav Rudd from devastation. The CN worker lives in a trailer parked outside his rental home in Jasper. He's in limbo, with a place to live that needs repairs before moving back in. But next door, the worst of the wildfire's wrath is on display. A house's foundation crumbles behind blue construction fences.
As you see, it was pretty close.
Rudd and his wife are one of many families who've stayed in campers since a July wildfire destroyed a third of the town. Some who did the same are back home already, but trailers have to come off the street soon, whether there's a backup plan or not.
Yeah, I hope we're gonna come back in our house in the end of October. Because they already broadcasting that should be snow with the rain, like in the next week.
Housing has been a struggle in different ways since the wildfire. Jasper staff say the town was already short 600 housing units. Now, it's more like 1,400, meaning residents, tourists, contractors, and seasonal workers are all competing for even less space. Essential workers who lost their homes had somewhere to stay first. Many are in local hotel rooms, mostly funded by the province. Those not in that category are on their own.
I also feel that I'm an integral part of this community.
Denise Millette and her partner Chuck Cantley work and volunteer in Jasper. They cobbled together house-sitting gigs to stay close to their destroyed property this winter, with no help, they say, from officials.
It was kind of being put out there
by all levels of government that there would be some kind of interim housing for everybody. Now, because we're deemed not essential, we are fending for ourselves.
There is housing coming, but the first round is already called for. The municipality is putting interim housing on three pockets of land previously earmarked for future construction. The hope is to house essential workers before December. Jasper's chief administrative officer, Bill Given, says the town is doing its best to keep up with demand.
The next step will be to put in orders for purpose-built units that would come earlier in 2025. And so, unfortunately, we're going to have to rely on residents to continue to be innovative, to continue to find solutions that work for them.
A push for patience as everyone tackles this monstrous cleanup. Sam Sampson, CBC News, Jasper, Alberta.
In India, it is not a crime for a husband to rape his wife as long as she is over 18 years old. A fight to change that in the penal code is going to the Supreme Court there, but it is facing opposition, including from India's government. Salima Shivji has that story for us and a warning. This story contains descriptions of sexual violence.
On the side streets of southeastern Delhi, the two young women huddle together as they walk. India's bustling capital is a safe haven for both as they struggle with the trauma of being raped repeatedly by their husbands. For this 21-year-old, the abuse began on her wedding night.
Without my permission,
my husband forced himself on me all the time, she says, six or seven times a day. She was barely 18, trying to understand how nobody would help her, even though her in-laws knew about the constant abuse. My husband used to say, now that we're married, you're my property, she says. I can do whatever I like. And in India, that idea seeps into law. Rape is illegal, but under the country's penal code, non-consensual sex by a man with his own wife, if she's over 18, is not rape, and therefore not a crime. That infuriates women's groups trying to change the law.
It's very heartbreaking at the same time.
Marital rape is so taboo in India's deeply patriarchal society, says counselor Monica Tiwari, that it takes extra work to get victims to open up.
There's no awareness about it. People don't understand that, you know, this is happening and this is wrong.
It's a battle all over India where sexual violence is normalized. A recent government survey found that Indian women are 17 times more likely to be sexually assaulted by their husbands than by others. Across the country, a woman is raped every 16 minutes, and those are just the reported cases. In August, the brutal rape and murder of a trainee doctor in Western India set off massive protests, shining a spotlight once again on how rape is treated in Indian society and how it's prosecuted. Cries for justice felt necessary but almost futile. There have been many other protests over the years, and yet little societal change, anti-rape activists like Miriam Davale say.
The conviction rate is only 27%. Nearly 75% of the criminals go scot-free.
And those are the cases that are reported and even get to court.
Yeah, that's just the tip of the iceberg.
Davale is with the All India Democratic Women's Association, one of the groups behind the court battle to criminalize marital rape. The case is wending its way through India's complex judicial system, slowly.
We realize that this is going to be a longer battle.
An uphill one. The Supreme Court has yet to hold hearings, but the Indian government submitted its position last week against making marital rape a crime, arguing that it would be excessively harsh, disproportionate, and could cause serious disruption to the institution of marriage. That line of thinking is not a surprise, says Davale.
This government is highly anti-women. It doesn't see women as independent identities, you know?
A painful thought for this mother of two girls, a rape survivor, who breaks down when she thinks of the panic attacks she used to have every time her husband came near. I didn't know how to get out of that awful situation, the 33-year-old says. I thought I just had to bear it. After 12 years and death threats, she's now in a shelter, and she wants justice for all of the wives suffering as she did at the hands of their husbands. If you're a man in India, you have all the rights, and girls have no rights, she says. So yes, a husband who rapes his wife needs to be punished. Her younger friend is also hoping for a change in the law, but mostly the 21-year-old longs to forget. I feel so very depressed when I think of my past, she says. I don't want to remember being raped and beaten so badly that I had to be hospitalized. She's looking to the future and filing for divorce. Salima Shivji, CBC News, Delhi.
Rome's Trevi Fountain is one of the city's most popular tourist destinations. In fact, it might be too popular. A record number of visitors are clogging up the heart of the Eternal City. So as Megan Williams tells us, Rome is considering measures to make the fountain a little more exclusive by making it a little more expensive.
At Rome's Trevi Fountain, a gushing Baroque masterpiece, it takes patience, even in the low tourist season, to get close enough to take in the centerpiece statue of Neptune, rippling with life. But this isn't low season, because in Rome, and in many other European cities, it's become high tourist season all year long. The crowd around the fountain is five rows deep, with as many as 12,000 people a day passing by to see it. To try to limit the numbers, Rome's mayor, Roberto Guartieri, has announced a plan to charge people to get a close-up look of the gleaming waterwork, with an option to reserve ahead of time. It's an enormous problem, says Rome city councillor in charge of tourism, Alessandro Onorato, of over-tourism in Rome's center, with residents moving out, and along with them, local artisanal shops that once made up the heart of the city. Last year, Rome hit an all-time high of 50 million visitors. This year, he says there'll be 4 million more. Onorato says the goal isn't to reduce the number of visitors. Rome's economy depends on tourism. But Italian cities don't have a say in what part of the city Airbnbs and hotels can open. That's governed by a national law that the present government doesn't want to change.
Oggi che cosa dobbiamo fare? Dobbiamo dare un senso a questo turismo.
So the only thing they can do is what Rome is doing now, promoting overlooked sites away from the historic center and putting up obstacles, like a fee, to jam-packed hotspots. For some, it might work. When asked if she'd pay to see the fountain, this woman from Chicago says,
Probably not. Because it's next week I just stopped by. Cause that was our
but this traveler from Australia says the fee might be necessary.
The crowds are just so much. You have to just keep it moving. Like, you don't get time to appreciate it fully, I think.
Though she and her partner admit they did skip the domed Pantheon, a nearby marvel of ancient architecture, because it now charges. I'm against making tourists pay to see the fountain, says this Rome office worker passing by on his lunch break. It won't make a difference. Rome's tourist councillor Alessandro Narato says if Italy's cities are drained of residents and local shops, they lose the authenticity tourists come for.
L'Italia, in qualunque posto vai, dal più piccolo al più grande, c'è sempre stata un'artigianalità.
Still, as Rome struggles to cope with waves upon waves of tourists, even he admits that as a tactic to keep visitors from the historic center, charging to see the Trevi Fountain is a drop in the bucket. Megan Williams, CBC News, Rome.
The exact origins of chess are unknown, but many historians believe it is based on an ancient strategy game from India. And while that game has been dominated by Eastern Europeans for decades, it's seeing rapid growth in the country where it was born. Freelance reporter Anupama Chandrasekaran has the story of two Indian prodigies trying to be the next chess grandmasters.
Checkmate.
Here at Chess Gurukul in Chennai, Ramesh Ramachandran has been training teenage chess stars like Pragnananda Ramesh Babu, or Prag as everyone calls him. In a country where cricket usually steals the spotlight, Prag's rise has really turned heads, Ramachandran says.
Like if Prag goes to an airport, people will know. Non-cricketing sportsmen are also getting being recognized by the public. So, yeah, even Magnus has said like chess future is in India.
Ramachandran is referring to 31-year-old Norwegian Magnus Carlsen, the number one chess player in the world. Earlier this year, 18-year-old Prague defeated Carlsen in a classical chess tournament. When Ramachandran traveled to Italy recently to train chess coaches, he was amused to hear about the Italian team's fear of Indian chess players.
They said, like, we should avoid tournaments where the Indian players are playing. This is the recommendation to the federation.
Here we have Vishwanathan Anand, world champion, number one in the world in chess.
Chess in India really took off when Vishwanathan Anand made his mark more than two decades ago. His win as the first Indian world champion was a game-changing move that put the country on the global chess map. But for decades after that, Indian players didn't make the top rankings. 19-year-old Prague is currently ranked among the top 20 in the world, while Gukesh, just a year younger at 18, has already secured a spot among the top 10. Vishnu Prasanna has been a key mentor for Gukesh. Like Ramachandran, he's part of a new generation of coaches who are gentle and supportive, helping players become more resilient. Prasanna has worked with Gukesh on how to stay cool under pressure.
You know, emotional regulation was something that we worked on for. That is one of the strong points, actually. Strength is all about recovery, they say. How quickly you can recover from excitement as well as disappointment.
If Pragnananda or Gukesh win the World Chess Championship, scheduled for later in the year, they will break the now 54-year-old Anand's record and become the youngest Indian player to win the title. But that isn't enough for Ramachandran, who wants to see an Indian player with longevity.
Someone who can dominate the game like how Magnus has dominated for many years. And the Indians are not afraid of anyone now. These kids, they are like hunters.
Anupama Chandrasekaran for CBC News, Chennai.
Here is the man that this crowd wants to see, Vince Carter.
More than 24 years ago, a basketball legend wows the crowd, showing off his slam dunks.
And here is Vince Carter with his first shot. Let's go home! Let's go home, ladies and gentlemen!
Decades later, Vince Carter taking those slam dunk skills to the Basketball Hall of Fame. The former Toronto Raptor is set to be inducted tonight. And it's well-earned. During his first season in Toronto, he was named Rookie of the Year, and Carter led the Raptors to their first ever playoff appearance. Speaking yesterday, here's what the basketball star said you had to do if you wanted longevity in the NBA.
Want to. Willingness to do whatever it took to last. I never even thought of it. I never, at 20 years, prior to it being told to me, I never even knew, like, cared who played 20-something years. Like, I wasn't chasing a record. I was chasing that dream still. I really do this. Been flowing stupid
since Vince Carter was on some through the legs arm in a hoop. Not only has he been referenced repeatedly by rapper Drake in music, Vince Carter still holds the Toronto Raptors' scoring record in a single season, and he's an eight-time NBA All-Star. He is the first and only player in NBA history to suit up in four different decades. He'll be inducted into the Hall of Fame tonight in Massachusetts. We'll leave you now with Weston Road Flows by Drake on Your World Tonight. I'm Anis Haidari in Calgary. Thanks for listening.
Western Road Flows, I did it for my granny. Back when we couldn't buy pizza because we were down to pennies. Feel like we go back a century, run to the store for centuries. Then bring it back to your brother, man. We had to respect it. He was wavy doing mixtapes.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.